to do is, I would like to, it's an interesting thing, but the Haftorah for last week's reading actually discusses, brings out the points that we were going over last week. And that is the, let me just show you where it is. It's in Malachi, okay? It's Malachi 3, 13. Okay? Now, what it says is, your words have been strong against me, says the Lord. Yet you say, what have we spoken against you? Now God answers. So God says, you have said, it is vain to serve God. And what profit is it that we have kept his commandments, and that we walked with great difficulty, mournfully, before God. And they continue, and they say, the people say, and now we're respecting the evildoers. And those who have done, those wicked people, those who have done evil deeds, they even tested God and escaped. Okay? So, what is the question here? That, the prophet, what is the prophet discussing here? This is a concept that the prophet is trying to bring out. And he says, God says to the people that your words have been very strong against me, and the people say, what did we say against you? So then God says, you said that there's no benefit in serving God, and what do we gain out of the fact that we kept his commandments and that we walked within the darkness, so to speak, mournfully before the Lord, before the God of hosts. And now we're respecting, we have to pay respect to wicked people. And the evildoers, they even tested God and escaped. Nothing happened to them. Okay? Now take a look at the next verse. The very next verse is a cryptic verse. And when the prophet and the Torah, the rule is when things become cryptic, it means there's an idea here which you have to search out. But take a look at this next verse. It says, then they who feared the Lord spoke one to another. Okay, and it says, and the Lord hearkened and heard it. And a book of remembrance was written before him for those who feared the Lord and took heed of his name. Okay? And then God says, and these people shall be to me. They shall be mine, says the Lord of hosts, on that day which I appoint as my particular day. And I will spare them, and I will... Well, actually, I don't like this translation. It says, and I will have compassion upon them as a man has compassion on his son that serves him. And then the prophet continues and he says, then you'll return and you'll see the difference between a righteous person and an evildoer, between he who serves God and he who has not served God. Okay, and then it speaks about, of course, it goes into the end of time, the end of days, which is, the Olam Haba, the eschatological, okay, and it describes what will happen to the evil and how the righteous will how before the righteous there will be light, etc. Okay, now, but before we get to the eschatological part, let's just move back. What happened here? Look carefully. There's some interesting verses here. God says to the people that your words have been very strong against me. And the people say, what do we say against you? Okay? Then God says, you said there's no benefit in serving God. And what do we gain out of following all his commandments and all the difficulties we went through? And then then God says that you say that that people even tested God, which means they did things against God and they got away with it. Okay? Then it says, then the prophet says, then spoke one to another those that fear God. And God listened, and he heard, and he wrote it down in the book before him for those that fear God and the ones that respect his name. Now, What did they say? What did those that feared God say? Doesn't say a word. It says they spoke, God listened, he wrote it down. Obviously, the prophet is trying to convey an idea over here. Okay? He demands that you look into his words and sift out and discover what he means. Let's take the first part. What is the first part? The first part is where he states, the people say, what did they say, God says you've spoken against me. And the people say, what did we say? Apparently the people didn't know what God meant. And then God says, no, you did say something. You said that there is no purpose in what do we gain by serving God? Okay? And then we had questions also, because we saw people that were evil, they were built up, respected, we have to respect them. And we see people that that test God, which means they go against his word. Nothing happens to them. Okay? What theory? We have to understand, if God says to the people, you've spoken against me, and they say, what did we say? And then God explains it to them, what is this dialogue? If people speak against God, they know it, and they know that God knows it. So how could people deny this? How could they say, well, we didn't speak against you, and then God says, no, you did. What kind of a dialogue is this, you see? But you'll see that the prophet is really saying something that's very deep here. You see, people, and then the prophet says later, and then you'll return and you'll see between those that really serve God and those that don't serve God. Those that really fear God, those that don't really don't fear God. What do you mean that really? I mean, isn't that pretty obvious? Can't you tell who serves God and who doesn't serve God? It should be pretty simple. The answer is like this. The answer is, when people read the prophets, they read it simplistically, and they just think of like the good guy and the bad guy. It's all as simple as that. But the prophet speaks on a very deep level. See, the prophet is speaking in the first instance where God says to the people, you've spoken against me, and then they say, well, what do we say? And God explains what they say. What? Let's take a look carefully. What did they say, and what theory are they operating with? Okay? They said, what benefit is there in serving God? They said, the evil people are successful, and we have to bow down to them, we have to kowtow to them, so to speak, and give them respect, and they get away with it. Okay? What theory are they operating on? What's the theory of those people? See, these are not people that don't keep the Torah, because if they're people that don't keep the Torah, so then obviously they're wicked, and when God asks them, what did you say against me? What did I say? We didn't say anything against you. We just don't keep the Torah. We just don't do anything. You see, that's ridiculous. There wouldn't be any dialogue there. But what God is speaking to a certain kind of person that does keep the Torah. But in the back of his mind, he says, what benefit is there? What am I going to gain out of all this? What theory is such a person operating with? Such a person is operating under the theory of compensation. That's what we've discussed until now. That's the average person. The average person thinks in terms of compensation. And it doesn't mean these people were not religious. No, they were very religious. Just only in the back of their mind, they worked with the theory of compensation. And that's what God. That's why when God says you've spoken against me, they say, what do we say against you? We keep the laws. We do things. What should we do to Torah? What are we doing bad? So God says, no, you are doing something wrong because you really are looking for a compensation. In the back of your mind, you say that, hey, look, what are we getting out of this? Okay? So it doesn't matter if you keep the Torah. It doesn't matter if you do the laws. If you are doing everything because of compensation, that's what you have in the back of your mind, then you really aren't a righteous person and you don't understand what righteousness is. You see? That's what the prophet is trying to bring out. Okay? It's not a simplistic concept. It's a very deep concept, and it applies to most people even today. Now take a look at verse 17, and you'll see. I don't know if it's actually verse 17 in your Bible. In the Hebrew edition, it is that way. Okay? Now, verse 17, it says, then those that fear God spoke one to another. And it says, and God listened, and he heard, and he wrote it down in a book of remembrance before him that is designated for those that fear God and those that respect his name. Okay. Now, the question we raised is that what is this conversation? Well, what do they say? I mean, it says God listened and he heard. Heard what? Okay? Now, the thing, what the prophet is saying is like this. You know, it's interesting. See, the prophet is saying that the people spoke to each other. Now, the rabbis say, what were they talking about? So the rabbis, Talmud says, they were talking about Torah. They were involved, engaged in Torah discussions. Which Torah discussions? Doesn't matter. They were engaged in Torah. What does that mean? It means like this. It means that at the time when other people were raising questions, they were saying, hey, you know, there's no, what are we getting out of this? We're keeping the Torah, keeping the commandments, and we're not getting any compensation. So they were operating, these people were operating under the principle of compensation. But the people, the ones that truly feared God, what did they do? They just kept studying Torah. Because they know that the true benefit for man is to be involved in Torah. That is the true good. You don't do that for compensation. You do that because that's the best thing that a person can do. That's like the story with Rabbi Akiva, where when the Romans prohibited the study of Torah, so he went out and he studied Torah. And they asked him why. He said the fox one time went to a brook and tried to talk the fish into coming out of the water. He said, it'll be much better on the land for you. It's much nicer out here. So the fish responded. They said, if in the water, where is our place of habitat, this is our natural habitat, we live in fear constantly. Can you imagine if we went out in the land? So Rabbi Akiva said, that's the same thing with us. He says, Torah, this is something which is a necessity. This is natural for us. This is the environment that is made for us. If we're in danger over here, could you imagine if we leave this environment, how dangerous it'll be? So the person that keeps Torah because he knows this is the good, not the compensation theory, that is the person that truly fears God. And that's why the prophet says that then you'll see the difference in that time. It's speaking about the time when the ultimate redemption, at the time of the ultimate redemption, these two groups of people are going to be existing. Which two groups? Those who keep the Torah because of the theory of compensation, in the back of their minds are looking for compensation, and the other ones who do it because they know it's the good. Okay? So, therefore, the prophet says that you'll be able to see the difference between the person that is truly serves God and the one that didn't serve God. What does it mean? It means the one that serves God out of compensation, that's not really a person that's serving God. That's not a person that recognizes the true good, which God has taught man in the Torah. But the person that's looking for something else. And when it becomes difficult, these people will abandon the way of Torah. But the person who recognizes that the good is really the Torah itself, that is the good, that person will never leave the Torah. That's why it says, see, whenever it says that God listened and he heard and he wrote down in the book, what is the prophet trying to say? The prophet is trying to say that these people are involved in something eternal. You see, that's what it means. When God listens and God writes down, that parable of God writing down is used to express eternal truth. It means that God listened to them because they were truly functioning on the level of man, which means they were truly acting in a way that man acts when he partakes of those things that are eternal.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Can you identify the fears of God there?
Excuse me?
Can you identify the fears of God? Who are these that fear God?
Yes, the ones who... Well, the prophet does identify those people.
Okay.
The prophet identifies those people as the ones who do the commandments of God's commandments because they know they are good. They are the only good for man. This gives man his happiness. It gives him everything that is good. Those are the ones that the prophet is identifying. He says, those are the ones that ultimately, in the ultimate day of redemption, it says that that for them, and that's what it says in the in verse 20, it says, but to you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness shall arise with healing in its wings. and you shall go out and leap like calves from the stall. So those are the ones that are going to, in the ultimate day of redemption, those are the ones that are going to not only survive, but they'll be living in the best possible way. Okay? So those are the ones that are going to live and see the ultimate redemption. Whereas the people who do, even people who keep the Torah, but if they have this in the back of their mind, they have this question. And why do people have this question in the back of their mind? Because they're operating under the theory of compensation. That's why the prophet doesn't even answer the question. If you take a look at that, God says, "Why did you speak against me?" They say, "What do we say?" No one. And a person who serves God because of the theory of compensation, which most people in the back of their mind are waiting for God to compensate them, they don't feel they're doing anything wrong. They feel on the contrary, they're religious, they're righteous. That is what the prophet is pointing out, that God says to them, why do you speak against me? Say, what do we speak? We don't say anything against you. So then God says, no, you do. Because the moment you are operating under the theory of compensation, then you're speaking against God, because you're removed from God and from his knowledge and from his Torah, where he teaches you that the reason why you should keep the Torah, as it says in Deuteronomy many times, is for your good. This is the good. God, in his kindness, gave us the Torah and revealed to us truths which guide our life. If we follow those truths, we have a good life. If we don't, who do we harm? Not God, we harm ourselves. So a person that doesn't understand this concept, even though he keeps the Torah, is really not a righteous individual. And that's why it says, you will see on that day, in the day of the ultimate redemption, the differentiation will be made between the righteous and between the wicked. That's one group. And this is in verse 18. And between he who serves God and he that didn't serve God. Why does the prophet say he that serves God, he that didn't serve God? That's an obvious thing. You can tell right away who a person serves God or doesn't serve God. No, what the prophet is saying is, on that day it'll be revelation which will distinguish between a person that really serves God, which means a person that does the good because it is the good, and a person who just looks like he's serving God, but he's not serving God. He's serving some kind of he's working on a fantasy compensation type of modus operandi. That is not a truly, that's not a person that truly serves God. Okay? This is exactly what the prophet is trying to express. These ideas are expressed in these few verses. So, that's why, by the way, if you take a look at this, it's an interesting thing. But grammatically, when it says, see, this you can't do unless you know the Hebrew, because where it says in verse 16, then they who fear the Lord spoke to one another. Now, ordinarily, this word, the way it would be dibru. Dibru means to speak. Daber, that means to speak. But here is one of four times in the entire Tanakh that you find a different form of this word. And here you find the word is not dibru, but nidburu. Now, nidburu, grammatically, is the grammatical form that it comes from is called nifal. It means passive reflexive, okay? Which means to say like this, that if I want to say, for instance, if I want to say a person is doing an action which shows the state of the person, it means, so to speak, descriptively, I say it means they're fully involved in it, I use that form of the verb. For instance, if a person is taking a shower, so you say, misrachet. You don't say he is washing himself. You say he is involved in washing. He's being washed. He's doing an action that turns back on himself and reveals something about his own state. Okay? Now, it's very interesting, but this form of the word, using that form in the word to speak, is only found four times. Two of them are right here in Malachi. Okay? Now, the reason is because over here, precisely as the Talmud explains, over here, the reason why it doesn't say what they said is because it's not important what they said. What the prophet is trying to say is, if you translate it properly, you'd have to translate it this way. Then those that fear God were engaged, involved themselves in speaking. You see? That would be the proper translation. Not spoke. spoke is the ordinary form of the verb. Over here it means, then those that feared God, they involved themselves in speaking one to another. It's reflexive. It means, not sometimes a person speaks, he's trying to communicate some idea. So he has an objective. He's doing an action, just like any other action. But over here it's, he is being involved in speaking. So the prophet carefully selected that form of the word to show that it's not important what they said. What we're trying to show is they were engaged in speaking. This was the this is what was virtuous about those who fear God. They were engaged. What were they speaking? What does it mean they engaged in speaking? They were engaged in speaking about Torah. And that's why it says that God listened and he heard and he wrote it down. It means these things, these ideas that they're engaged in are eternal ideas. The Talmud, for instance, says in Gittin that two scholars were having a debate. And then one of them later met Elijah the prophet. And he says, what is God doing? He says, he is discussing this argument that the two of you are having. So the other person said back to Elijah, says, how could that be? He says, God knows what the truth is. Well, this is just an argument. We don't know, but God knows the truth. So Elijah said, no. He says, what both of you are saying are the words of the living God. That means to say that even when there's an argument and there's only one truth, but the important thing is that both people are analyzing the problem logically, and that is really partaking of the eternal. As long as you're analyzing, and that's why in the Talmud, usually, the Talmud is not really that concerned so much with the outcome of a problem. It's a philosophy of education that the Talmud has. The Talmud's philosophy of education is, important is not the conclusion, what is important is understanding the problem properly. That's more important than the conclusion. Many times you have in the Talmud, you left pages of analysis, of dissertation on a problem. Then the Talmud comes to the conclusion, one line. And the conclusion is, boom, boom, boom. This is what we do. This is the way we practice. Conclusion is not really the important thing. Understanding the problem properly, that's the important thing. Of course, when man uses his mind to understand Torah, then he's involved in the eternal world of God. So when he does that, then he achieves his perfection. And that's really why the prophet over here does not say what they spoke about. It says God listened, and he heard, and he wrote it down. It means these things that these people are involved in, these are eternal things. What God writes down is eternal things. God wrote the Torah because every word is eternal. God doesn't write down things that only have importance in a momentary way. Okay? So that is what the prophet is. That's what the prophet is saying. It's interesting that same form of the verb, of the reflexive, is also used, by the way, is also used in 13, where God says to the people that your words have become very strong against me. He says, and you will say, what did we speak against you? Okay? Again, over here, that form of the verb is used, which means, what were we involved in speaking against you? Which means, you see, the prophet is trying to show that over here, when a person complains about God, the words have no value. The words are not important. What's important is the state of the person. This person is involved in a low state of existence. And that's why the prophet has used the same word twice to show that there are two cases where what the person says is not important. It's the state of the person that's important. And that is when a person complains against God and he misses the whole point of the Torah because he operates under the theory of compensation. So then what he says has no value. It's meaningless. Not important. What's important is that this person is unfortunately in a bad state. That's why he uses that form of the verb. He's involved in a wrong kind of talking. A talking that stems from his emotional, primitive side. But then the prophet uses that same form of the verb to show that there is a kind of involvement which is the good kind of involvement. That is the involvement in ideas, in Torah, in God's God's thoughts that he conveyed to us in through the Torah. This is the good kind of involvement. So that's why, if you notice in Malachi, that's why he puts them in juxtaposition to each other. You see, the righteous and the wicked. And he who serves God, he who doesn't serve God. And that's why he uses the same form of the verb, which is only found in two other places, by the way. And in both cases, it means the exact. In both cases, it means the same kind of thing. It says it doesn't mean the speech has any value, but it means complaining. You see, the translation is really complaining. It's found in Psalms and it's found in Ezekiel. Both have the same meaning. So this form of the verb is a form of the verb that reflects attitude in the individual. Okay, and it also reflects a certain kind of spontaneity. By the way, a spontaneity. It means you see you're all of a sudden involved, and the spontaneity is in both cases. There's wicked spontaneity and there's righteous spontaneity. Wicked spontaneity is where a person, something bad happens, he complains against God, he's angry. This is a certain spontaneous reflex which conveys a certain attitude. The primitive man operating here. But on the other hand, the reflex where a person is spontaneously involved in Torah, spontaneously thinks of Torah, this is a reflex which gives man, allows him to partake of the eternal. That's when, that's what the prophet means, and he gives you a parable by saying God listened and wrote it down in his book, because those things will always remain before God, because those things are truly the eternal. So, there is, according to Torah, we mentioned the question of God's justice. There is a proper way to approach it and an improper way. If a person approaches it emotionally, how could God do this? Then you know right away he's operating under the compensation theory. That's the improper way of dealing with the problem. The Torah likes to deal with all problems, but the Torah demands of man that he deals with it in the proper manner, which means that he deals with it on an intellectual level. The dealing with it should be motivated by a quest for the truth and knowledge and understanding, not because the person is emotionally trying to justify something. He's complaining. He maintains that things are unfair. Then he's not involved in an inquiry. He's just a foregone conclusion, and he's just operating on the basis of his emotions. But the entire book of Job, of course, was dedicated to the problem of God's justice. That was, our tradition says that Moses wrote that book. That was because that was done properly in the proper manner of investigation. That is the righteous person thinking. That's the eternal ideas. But the person who operates under the compensation theory and claims exactly as the prophet says over here, there's no benefit in serving God. Look at these people. They don't serve God. They get away with it. Why should I do it? What did I get out of it? And then you're working on the compensation theory. Then you're not operating on the proper level. This is not an investigation. This is a complaint. This is a foregone conclusion. This person is operating with a foregone conclusion. This is the one that doesn't serve God. And even if they keep the commandments, even if they keep the Torah, that still is not serving God. That's what the prophet is saying, that in that day, God will distinguish between those people who operate under the compensation theory and those people who recognize the true good. Okay, I think it should be time to turn the tape.
You're right.
Okay, now the Passover, as everyone knows, is a night when the things are discussed at the Seder and ideas are discussed. As a matter of fact, just this morning we were studying the piece of Talmud that translates, the word says, in the Torah it says, poor bread. But the word is written, the letters mean poor, but the pronunciation that we use has another meaning also. The not bread of affliction, but it means bread of answering, speaking. So the Talmud says that means this bread, this matzah that we eat, is bread that we say many things over it. Okay, we say many things over this bread. It's an interesting concept, but an important one. Which means to say that the bread is, I would say, it's intellectual bread. In other words, before we eat the matzah, we have long discussions, ideas, concepts, philosophy, commandments, Torah, Halacha. We say a lot over that bread before we get to it. Why? Because the eating then that actually, according to Halacha, that actually qualifies the matzah. And the reason is because the Torah gives us physical commandments, but the physical commandment is really there in order to engage the soul of man and the mind of man. So when God gave us the commandment of eating the matzah, it's not a ritual. It's not a mere symbolic action. That's not what it is. As a matter of fact, if God wanted to make the night of Passover symbolic, the proper way would be to do just like they did, which means, you know, to have the your belt tied and your staff ready and get dressed up as if you're going to leave Egypt. But that was not the way God did it. God saw fit. He took certain items that was there then and he made them into eternal commandments, but he never asked us to do things that would duplicate, would look like a symbolic kind of going out of Egypt. No such thing. The reason is very simple. The reason is because when people get involved in symbolic actions, the emotions are engaged. God wants the person's mind to be engaged, and he wants them to study those things that have to do with the going out of Egypt. That's very important. But essentially, the action really is created, the mitzvah is created to evoke the soul of man, not to put him in a state as if he's going out of Egypt and just symbolically bring him back to a fantasy that he's trying to fantasize the going out of Egypt. That's not what the Torah's objective is. As I said, if that were God's objective, so then, of course, the best way to do it would be, just like it's written in Exodus, to dress and be ready and eat the Paschal lamb in every generation as if you're about to go out, just like they did. And that was, for them, it was a commandment. They had to eat it in haste. But for the generations, that was never a commandment. Only certain things that are in that chapter on how they were obligated to eat it are eternal. Other things are not. So how do you know which is which? That's where you must have the law of the oral law, the scholars. And no one maintains, no scholar ever maintained that that those the other things and the that were obligated on them, in other words, such as having their staff in their hand and being ready to leave, that was a part of the eternal commandment. That was just something that they had to do in Egypt because of their situation and because of their state. And for them, that involved a perfection at that time. But eternally, forever, there's no such law. However, the Paschal lamb did remain forever. And matzah did remain forever. And the reason is, as I said, the reason why God removed those things which would be most symbolic of leaving Egypt and left some of them is the ones that actually, of course, matzah was eaten in Egypt, but the reason why he left the ones that are less attached to the actual going out is very simple, because God does not, the whole Torah teaches man that the mind and the soul has to be engaged in man, not the fantasy part, not to fantasize, not to be involved in symbolic fantasy of going out of Egypt. That's not what the Torah wants. The Torah wants you to understand, to think, to gain the knowledge of the ideas of the redemption. And the matzah is that's why the Talmud says the matzah is called, it's intellectual bread. It's bread that we speak many ideas about before we engage in eating it. Because the eating is a commandment, and halacha is extremely important. We cannot deviate one iota from any performance that God commanded us to do. The action is important because the action engages us, forces us to be engaged, it pulls us in to the ideas of Torah. And that's the unique process of halacha. The unique process of halacha. Only Torah has such a concept. Now, what I'd like to discuss tonight is what is the concept of miracles? Okay, what is the idea of miracles, and what is the importance of miracles? People are drawn to miracles, and primitive religions always try to pull man into miracles. Miracle workers. We in the Torah don't have miracle workers. We never did. Most of the prophets, we don't find any miracles. The exception, of course, is Elijah and Elisha, his student, and that was only because at that time the Jews were so swayed away from Torah, it was necessary to have miracles like the miracle at Mount Carmel, because they were all steeped in idolatry. Elijah, that's why Elijah, by the way, if you look carefully into the prophets, you'll see Elijah is like a miniature of Moses. He went 40 days without food. A little differently, though. You got to look carefully there. A little differently. He went to Horeb because he functioned like Moses in a small way. Of course, the Torah says no one will ever be like Moses, and Moses on a different quality, different level. But Elijah was the greatest of the prophets, and he was similar. That's why in the prophecies depicted as being similar to Moses, because he also, through miracles, he brought the people back to he was able to combat the idolatry, and in order that Torah should remain with us. But essentially, Torah really veers away from miracles. Miracles really don't really have any lasting effect on people. That's why the Torah insists on knowledge. But miracles do teach us something. They are not unimportant. They teach us something. What do miracles teach us? You see, it's not the fantasy of miracles, the illusion of miracles. People are attracted to miracles because people are basically looking for sensationalism. And this is really primitive religions. Always have miracles, miracle healers, miracle workers, all these type of things. Our Torah, we have prophets that teach ideas, that teach knowledge, not prophets that perform miracles. Okay, as a matter of fact, the Messiah King, as Maimonides says, is not necessary for him to perform miracles. That's not what he will come to do. He'll come to do what Isaiah says, to teach people, to teach man, to enlighten mankind. So the question is, what do miracles teach? And why was it necessary to have miracles at all? After all, I mean, the Torah says that Mount Sinai is once and forever. Never will happen again. God doesn't like to destroy the laws of nature, to compromise the laws of nature. The laws of nature are beautiful. All the prophets speak about the fact that the laws of nature express the greatness and the wisdom of the Creator, and to even momentarily to interfere with them is not really God's will. He had to do it; it was necessary, but it was only done in order to, because it was necessary for a moment at that time, in order to establish certain truths for man, but not on an ongoing basis. Now, but what does it teach man? What do miracles teach man? So Nachmanides very beautifully explains what the whole purpose of the miracles in Egypt were. And he says that the reason why miracles were necessary, is because there were certain theories, and there are certain theories that people hold. And it's very difficult for man to arrive at the truth just from his own intellect. And even if he would arrive at the truth from his own intellect, certain areas he can, other areas it's basically impossible for him to arrive at the truth. There's no way that he could logically know certain things. And even those things which he can know, there are only a few people that are able to think on that level. You see, thinking on a true Torah level demands two things. It demands a very great intellect, that's number one, but it also demands a certain type of emotional makeup. A person has to have the proper emotions, and also it demands a certain kind of perfection of the personality, which means the person is searching for truth and not trying to say things that fall in line with their own emotions. People are always trying to... That's the problem with those who misinterpret the Torah. They have preconceived notions, and what they try to do is look for some verse or something that seems, or they think on the surface, is saying what they believe. And then they'll say, oh, that's right there in the Bible. You see? That is not the method of Torah. The method of Torah is for a person to... because they're searching for truth, not because they want to justify certain premises that they, certain illusions that they have. But my Nachmanides explains, he says, like, what were these theories? There's several theories. Some people simply, of course, didn't believe in God at all. They just like today, people that are atheists, they just do not believe in God. They only believe in nature. And they say that the universe is the only real thing. There's nothing beyond, behind the universe. That is reality. And of course, you know, there are many scientists today, many people today that, still believe that. And then he says, some say, others said, that, no, God exists, but God is the source of all knowledge. Yes, true. But God doesn't have knowledge of particulars. See, that happens to be a very big philosophical theory, that God can only know universals. He can't know particulars. He cannot know that a particular ant is moving on a particular leaf at a specific time. That God doesn't know, because God's above that. All he knows is universals. He created everything, and he created them with universal principles, because, you know, everything in the universe works according to laws, and he is the author of all those laws. But he doesn't know particulars. They're too unimportant for him, and they're not. He simply has no knowledge of them. That is a theory. By the way, one of the people in the Torah that held that theory to a degree was Balaam, because Balaam said that was one of the things that Balaam thought to himself. He said that the reason why he went, in spite of the fact that God warned him that he won't go, was because when God said to him, "Who are these people that are with you?" So Balaam said, you see that? He doesn't know every detail. I'm going to pursue this further, and I'll figure out when he doesn't know things, and then I'll be able to do things against his will. So Balaam really was dabbling in that theory. That's a well-known philosophical theory, that God doesn't know particulars, and that's one of the theories that miracles were brought into existence to disprove. Another theory, a third theory, is that God knows. He knows everything. He knows the general principles, of course, of the universe, and he also even knows the particulars of the universe. But the only thing is that God simply does not care. He's not involved in human life. Human life is not important enough for God to be involved in. And that theory is mentioned by the prophets. Ezekiel mentions it. God has left the land, okay? Which means that's the theory of those, and many philosophers maintain that way, and many great thinkers thought that way, too, that God knows. As a matter of fact, Albert Einstein was of that opinion, that he believed in God, and he thought that God is all-knowledgeable, but he says God doesn't really bother with man. Man is not important enough. You see, the greater a person is, the more knowledge a person has, the less important he realizes he is, because he studies about so many things that are more important, more embracing than his little self. The ignorant person is always involved in their own little petty emotions. Their whole life revolves around the self. So therefore, they really can't get too far, and they always feel the self is extremely important. That's why the ignorant person always feels, hey, how could God do this to me? Because he feels he's the center of the universe, and of course, God must be concerned with him. But the more intelligent person, like an Einstein or a great thinker, realizes that man is really very unimportant in terms of the scheme of things. So he says the opposite thing. That God can't be involved with man. Man is too unimportant. As a matter of fact, King David expresses that in Psalms, where he says, what is man that you should remember him? Because King David was an intelligent individual, and he was a high-level person, and he recognized that human life, really, if you look at it objectively, what is human life? We're relatively like nothing. But a speck in the universe. But nevertheless, King David says, as paradoxical as it is, we know the truth from the Torah that God is concerned about us. So we're fortunate in that sense. So Nachmanides explains, he says, that the purpose of miracles is to disprove all the above theories. Why? Because when God wrought miracles in the land of Egypt, and it was demonstrated that these miracles were done by God for the people of Israel at a specific time, when Moses predicted, and for the purpose of redeeming them, that's the concept of redemption, and everyone saw that, so then it dispelled all these doubts. It showed that God exists. It showed that God has knowledge of every detail, and it showed that God is concerned about man, and he relates to man. Okay? That was the reason, the only reason, that God did the miracles in Egypt. He didn't do it to really get people emotionally involved with Torah because of miracles. Because, as you understand, just any person that has any sense knows that if that were the case, then it would be unfair to all succeeding generations who live at times when there are no miracles. So that when God would be unfair, he gave these people, he gave them such great opportunity because he did miracles for them. But the other generations he didn't do. People live centuries and centuries, they don't see any miracles. Obviously, the answer is that the miracles do not help you in any way. Because even a person who sees miracles, the miracle does not improve the individual. No passes, no, nothing that happens to a person improves them. There's only one thing that improves the person. The person works on himself and perfects himself. And that's why you see throughout the Torah, even though they saw those miracles, you see that they lapsed. I mean, they were unable to, many times, they were unable, ten instances, they backslid. The reason is because the only way for a person to advance truly is to work on himself, to improve himself, to change his inner structure, the inner structure of the psyche, to perfect himself, to guide, to this is something a person can only do himself with the benefit of Torah. Torah gives you the guide, but you have to work on yourself. And no miracle that a person experiences is ever going to improve him one iota. Doesn't do a thing. Okay? As a matter of fact, you see, as soon as they saw the miracles, a few days later, already they were backsliding. Why? Because the miracle is a momentary effect. But we often think, well, if I saw a miracle, it wouldn't mean a thing, because as long as a person is not perfected, he's never going to be free of envy, jealousy, hatred. All his desires and his energies are not going to be changed by that. The energy is going to still be going into those same areas. The only way you're going to redirect your energies into a higher sphere is through working on yourself and studying Torah and gaining more knowledge. That's the only thing that's going to improve you. So Nachmanides explains, that is why, that was the purpose of the miracles. Miracles really weren't done in order to impress people or in order to improve them. That's not the way to improve man through miracles. The Torah never really uses miracles to improve people. It always shows people just on the contrary. In spite of all the miracles, the people are still the same. They still haven't been improved, which is clearly what the Torah is trying to show us, is exactly the opposite, that miracles, rather than improving people, doesn't do anything for them. But what does it do? This is what Nachmanides explains. If it doesn't do anything, so why did God do them? The answer is because miracles demonstrate a truth about God. Now, certain things, certain areas, you see, man can discover God on his own. This we know from great thinkers that came to the conclusion that God exists. We know it from our father Abraham, who was also a great thinker and also came to the same exact conclusion. But a person can never prove that God, this God, who is the creator of the universe, yes, there must be a being that's different from the creation, that's behind all this wisdom and knowledge, that is not like the creation. That is the creator. That, an intelligent person can come to that conclusion. Just like Albert Einstein did, and many others. But they will never be able to come to the conclusion that this source of existence relates to man. That's something, how are you going to prove that? How are you going to come to that conclusion? Very difficult to do. So this kind of knowledge is not something you can glean, like King David says, the heavens declare the glory of God. That's true. From studying the heavens, studying astronomy, studying the universe, you can see God. That's true. But can you see from the universe that God relates to man? On the contrary, you're going to say man is a speck. He's nothing. And the more knowledge you have, the more insignificant a person's individual personal life and preoccupations seem. To a small person, preoccupations seem very important. This happened to me today. That happened. When you study big things, all these things seem silly. And you realize that's really the benefit of Torah. Torah takes man into a higher world where he's involved in important things. What the Torah is trying to do is to get a person to see that these little silly things in their life that they think are so important, that aggravate them or even to make them happy, these things are unimportant, they're nonsensical. So the greater individual, you see, moves away from that kind of self-importance into the sphere of wisdom and knowledge. Move into that sphere, you can come to the conclusion, hey, there's so much knowledge in the universe. What am I? A little speck of nothing. So God had to show man that this is not true. As much as logically that's what we should conclude, but we can't draw logical conclusions because God is the only one that has the true conclusion. We may be able to understand the thing logically, and we're obligated to follow our mind, but that's only when something is absolutely logical. If something is 100% logical, the Torah says, that's it. We know it's true. But when you're drawing conclusions, that's a different kind of logic. In other words, if something's logical, it means two different things. If A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C, that's pure logic. But when you draw conclusions like, oh, it doesn't seem to me like God has to do with the man, that's logical differences. It makes sense. We should really say it makes sense. But something that makes sense to man is not necessarily true. That we don't have. That power we don't have. We have good intuition, but our intuition is also flawed. We make mistakes when we follow our intuition. Sometimes we're right. Sometimes the intellectual intuition, by the way, is the basis of a whole Talmud. Because the whole Talmud, the right for Talmudic scholars to debate is because they have a right to operate on their intuition. But that's in the sphere of halacha. That's in the sphere of science, in the sphere of mathematics, and there we have a right to operate on our intuition. But when it comes to conclusions about God, how God relates to the universe, there we're treading very thinly if we think that we can draw such conclusions. There we can't really draw conclusions. So a person will conclude based upon what's most comfortable. He has no choice. But God wrought miracles in Egypt in order to teach man that that's not true. That God really does relate to man. Now, Nachmanides says very beautifully, he says, now once you know that, he says, then you know that God relates to man not just through the miraculous, but on a constant basis. That if a person is worthy, and a person is living, and the higher type of existence an individual lives, the closer he is to God, which means he's more under his divine providence. It's an interesting thing, but we just celebrated Purim not too long ago, and we read the book of Esther, and the Talmud states that we have a funny calendar. Our calendar is lunar months, but it's basically a solar system because you always have to have the month of Nisan this month, the month of Passover. The Bible says it is the month of spring, so it always must be in the spring. Now, if you just have 12 months, you're going to have a problem. Pretty soon it's going to be in the winter, and then the fall is going to keep moving up. So, therefore, every 3 years, we intersperse another month. Now, you understand, halacha is a very precise science. You don't just do things simply, because since it's a delicate, a very delicate science. So when you have something structured and you start putting something in there, it's not so simple. There are a lot of halachic ramifications. And there is a great difficulty with that 13th month that comes up, because that 13th month, ordinarily it's the 12th, we call it Adar, and we have an Adar 1 and an Adar 2, is all question about what the concept of that second month is, and it's a difficult halachic concept, but I'm not going to go into that right now. But the point is that we say, why do we celebrate the Megillah in the second Adar? Why don't we do it in the first? Okay, because usually when you have a mitzvah, you try to do it as soon as possible. Over here, you're postponing it to the second month. But the Talmud explains because when they first formulated it, they wanted that the redemptions should be closer together, as close as possible. The redemption from Purim, that God redeemed the people and saved them from Haman, and the redemption from Egypt. Why are these two redemptions? What is the relationship between the two? Actually, the way Nachmanides explains it, it's a perfect harmony between the two. Because the miraculous events in Egypt that were really breaches in the laws of nature, that type of miracle God only did once. Because he wanted to demonstrate once for all. By the way, that's why this commandment of discussion about the miracles in Egypt is the one commandment that the Torah tells us you must tell to your son. Why? Because Nachmanides explains. He says, God is not going to perform miracles in every generation before the eyes of every evil person or every apostate or every atheist. He's not going to do that. So therefore, the commandment is over here. It's very important. You should tell your son, because it should be given over from one generation to another, so that this truth is learned through the system of transmission. And God is not through repetition of miracles, because God's not going to do that. So therefore, this commandment, which teaches us about miracles, teaches us a very important thing. There are two kinds of, you see, the redemption. What does redemption mean? Redemption is not an act on the part of God, just some sensational act. Hey, God just took these people out. Let's get excited about this. That's not what it is. Redemption is there to teach you a concept, that God relates to man. That is the concept. Now, that was demonstrated through breaches in the laws of nature in Egypt, but now we don't have that anymore. God's not going to do that again. But God is constantly relating to man, not through breaches in the law of nature, but through what Nachmanides calls and what the scholars call the hidden miracles. And that's the Book of Esther. So if you read the Book of Esther carefully, I believe we went through part of it, you'll see there isn't a single miracle in that book. And yet that book is the one that the scholars of the Talmud say will remain in the eventually, at the end of days, in other words, when the ultimate redemption...
Rabbi, you got about 1 minute.
Okay. During the time of the ultimate redemption, that book and the five books of Moses will remain, and the reason is because there's a harmony between those two. Because the five books of Moses was where God made breaches in the laws of nature to demonstrate certain truths. But the Book of Esther is an ongoing process. It means God is constantly relating to man through a hidden way, not through breaches in the law of nature. And that Book of Esther describes precisely, gives you insight into how that works. So the concept, the main concept that a person should derive from the whole night of the Seder, this is the essence of the whole thing, is that God relates to man. That's why Nachmanides says, it mentions many times in the Bible, this mitzvah is commemoration of going out of Egypt. Commemoration of going out of Egypt again and again and again. Why? Because the going out of Egypt